All right. 22 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock, like I said earlier on, Mr. Afro Raymond is in. So I say good morning to you. How are you doing, my friend?
Very well, very well. Thank you for having me here this morning on Power 102. It's always a pleasure to be with you on this radio station. I'm also with two other distinguished interviewers, so I'm actually trembling with nervousness.
Ha. Good one, Afro.
That was one for 10 points.
Thanks for coming and spending some time with us on such a rainy morning.
Absolutely.
Yes. You know, yes. I mean, I know you could have been, you know, home, wrapped up, warm, yes. You know, all swaddled and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, Afro, aren't bailouts a normal thing?
Well, there have been bailouts in the past. That's not in question. There have been bailouts in the past in world history, and most recently with the collapse in 2007 and 2008, which was what we call the Wall Street collapse, mm-hmm. which initiated the period that we know as the Great Depression too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the economists are calling it the Great Depression too. So great has been the impact of this decline.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that our bailout in Trinidad and Tobago is quite a different kettle of fish, you
uh-huh.
know. Not to say that it's fishy, but it's a different kettle of fish. We have a really different scenario taking place here, and our bailout has been one that has attracted some attention from myself and other people for other reasons. I know you have other people coming in this morning, but we had the Caribbean's wealthiest man being bailed out by a government and a political party to whom he had made phenomenal donations. In fact, the records, as far as they're available, we don't really have any proper records about campaign finance in this country.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of rumors and allegations.
Mm-hmm.
But the records that are available tell us that, in fact, the largest, if not one of the largest donors to the People's National Movement was CLICO and the CL Financial group. So, in fact, it's not possible to understand the bailout without taking a proper bearing on the role of party political finance in this entire affair. And of course, it's not just cash money, it's also influence and access to power. Because up until April 2008, Mr. André Louis Montay, who was the former finance director, group finance director of CL Financial, Mr. Montay left in April of 2008. Mr. Montay was also the treasurer of the PNM,
mm-hmm.
as well as being chairman of three or four powerful state enterprises. So we had somebody who, without question in my mind, up until May of 2010, was the most powerful person within that scenario, that
so
leadership.
Are you suggesting
and
that he might
have been one of the most powerful people within CL Financial?
Right. And so are you suggesting, given his, you know, the various caps that he was wearing, that he mm-hmm. might have been in an influential position?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. He was in a position to, let's put it this way, he was in a position to make a deal which few others were in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we got to be mature about it. That doesn't mean we accept it, but we got to be mature about it and understand that in our jurisdiction, that is the way things are. The big companies, whether it's Neil and Massey or Guardian Life or Ansem Akal, or in this case we're discussing CL Financial, the big companies have got that level of access, and they have their people as we say right up in there,
mm-hmm.
in the cabinet, in the huge decision making bodies that can actually see something before it happens and warn them. That's one of the ways you grow wealth.
Yeah.
And preserve your wealth.
But in an issue like with CL Financial and the bailout mm-hmm. that would have occurred, the fundamentals though, would the bailout have been necessary mm-hmm. and was it a good thing mm-hmm. or did it occur simply because the parliamentarians and cabinet ministers to make the decision because of that influence, and because they were also probably shareholders in CLICO anyway, made it as a matter of self-interest.
So
we know the Minister of Finance.
So public good or private good? Is that what you're...
So which one did both... Were both attended to in terms of that bailout of the CL Financial Group? Or?
Well, I don't think the public interest was properly attended to. I mean, the one statement I always return to, like a haunting nightmare, you don't want to return to it, but you have to return to it if you're going to sleep tomorrow night. And in fact, the one statement I return to is the statement by the former governor of the central bank, Ewart Williams, in which Ewart Williams gave a prepared statement
mm-hmm.
on the day of the bailout. It was Friday, the 30th of January, 2009. And at the bottom of the first page, he listed in the middle of the first page what were the reasons the bailout was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
There were four or five reasons. That the wrong investment strategy, they were raising money with high interest instruments, short-term instruments, they were using those high interest short-term instruments to fund long-term investments. There was an excess of interrelated party transactions and so on, a lack of proper accounting controls and so on. He went through a list of improper
mm-hmm.
and inadvisable things that the company had become involved in,
mm-hmm.
which had caused the crash.
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom of page one, he says, and this is the killer, William says in his prepared statement that we knew about all of this since 2004. So what we are contemplating here, and I'm going to keep repeating this until I there's more breath in my body. What we are repeating, what we are contemplating here, is the chief regulator of the country,
mm-hmm.
who was later shown to have investments in the very group,
mm-hmm.
saying that since 2004, since 5 years before the bailout, we knew all these things were wrong and had to be dealt with. And then he slips into a euphemism, which is a euphemism for a lack of political will in terms of changing the regulations. So the regulations were weak, and there were other circumstances that prevented us dealing with this. And in fact, that mysterious statement, the other circumstances, was interrogated by Coleman. And in fact, will form part of Coleman's report. This is the Commission of Inquiry
mm-hmm.
that is to be published in about 2 or 3 weeks' time, according to the latest information I have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very fertile question you've asked, Richard. What is the junction between public and private? Where do the two things intersect? Because the very governor, the very former governor who told us that the group wasn't good,
mm-hmm.
we knew they weren't good because they were doing these things. We have this huge crisis today. We knew they weren't good for 5 years. Later revealed that he had investments there.
Yeah.
So I always found it, I still find it impossible to reconcile those two things, that somebody who in fact is a leading regulator in the country, a person with top qualifications, I believe his CV, I don't believe his CV is anything funny about it, the man has an accomplished CV, okay, highly qualified, international level experience and so on, in reputable organizations. And you knew this problem was going on for 5 years and you still put money there. So it speaks about a rather, if I may, a rather tortured relationship. It speaks about a relationship in which parts of it are above the surface and parts of it are below the surface. It speaks about a number of things that we really need to contemplate seriously. What is that junction between public and private interest?
So you've raised the issue of the mm-hmm. Coleman report. What are you expecting to come out of that report? Because it was supposed to be due at the end of this month, right?
Yes, it was supposed to have been due at the end of May. Today is the 1st of June. But in fact, my latest information is that I think steps are being taken mm-hmm. to have it ready within the next 30 days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't say more than that, but my conversation, I've been following it up.
Right.
And I think in the next 2 to 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, we'll actually have the report.
Right.
That we could have a conversation about the contents of the report. I don't want to try to predict what he will and he won't say. Mm-hmm. He certainly in my, I attended a great many hearings.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly knew what he was talking about, Sir Anthony Coleman, QC. He's a former judge in England, and he's a deputy head of the arbitration court in Dubai. Sir Anthony Coleman certainly knew what he was talking about. I don't think any of the issues fazed him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He was frustrated in the conduct of the inquiry by the fact that several key witnesses did not make themselves available.
Mm-hmm.
So we had witnesses like the very Mr. Dupree and Mr. Montai. They claimed their constitutional right to avoid self-incrimination. So they did not appear as witnesses at all. And although they did not appear, they were represented at the inquiry by powerful lawyers. In the case of Mr. Montai, it was Mr. Martin Daly, senior counsel. And in the case of Mr. Dupree, it was the English Andrew Mitchell, QC. And those people took a very prominent role through the inquiry, raising every point, taking points, challenging things, and so on. And they were meticulous, and they were very, very strong on every point. But it was a little ironic for me. I mean, I'm not a learned person. I know one of us here is. But it was a little painful for me to contemplate somebody who could effectively refuse to participate in a commission of inquiry about something for which they no doubt had a significant responsibility, but in fact have a powerful person in the room
yeah.
identified as speaking for them
yeah.
and speaking and taking every point. That irony didn't rub very well with me. It was one of the odious for me as a non-lawyer, just as a citizen. Yeah. It was a very odious thing to see it every day. It was there in your face.
So is it, in other words, is there an argument then that the entire infrastructure of how we do commissions of inquiry mm-hmm. needs to be revisited absolutely want proper transparency and action on things? Because we have had so many commissions of inquiry in this country, I think we probably have the highest per capita.
Yes.
And for a lot of Trinidadians and Begonians, we get pretty cynical that anything's going to come out of it.
Well, you see, it's interesting. I mean, apart from my own discomfort with what happened in the Coleman inquiry and in other inquiries, and the point you were raising about what comes out of the commission inquiry, there is also a philosophical question. One of the issues that has been raised before, and certainly I know that Daly raised it in some of his writings, one of the issues that have been raised before is that philosophically there's an uncomfortable fit in between, on the one hand, an adversarial court system that in fact will identify a person for prosecution, and that person is charged and prosecuted, and if they're not successful in defending themselves, they'll be convicted.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, so to speak, a more inquisitorial examination of the facts, which is a commission of inquiry. And how do the two things fit together when they focus on the same person? So there's a real kind of, so we have both instruments exist in our law. We have commissions of inquiry are a lawful process. And we also have the right to charge somebody for something, for example, in the case of Clicquot, possibly fraud. And that person would have to face a very serious charge. And things that they said in the commission of inquiry could be used to implicate them in the trial.
You think anything's going to come out of the Coleman inquiry in terms of that? You think anybody's going to be charged?
Well, I think the charging of people in this country, traditionally, there's been one or two bizarre exceptions, but the charging of people in this country have tended to follow a kind of a childish game. I think a lot of our episodes in our public life resemble childish games. And when you were little, we played this game called Seesaw. And when you were up, I was down. And when I went down, you went up. And it's like that with the politics. So when this party is in power and they get angry and they prosecute, you would find the prosecutions or the charges or the pointed allegations coming against people from the other party, and vice versa. You would never get politician A making pointed allegations against somebody in his party. You had that with Mr. Manning and Dr. Rowley.
Mm-hmm.
But that, as I said, that's one of the exceptional things in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pattern of a seesaw. So we need to get to the point where, in fact, people are prosecuted for breaking the law. And we need to, those of us doing this kind of work need to insist on it. You know, so I'm not hopeless about it. We need to insist on it. The Coleman inquiry is going to be huge. Some of the things it will cover would include the role of the central bank, which I touched on.
Well, you just talked
on
about that, and I, yes, wanted to ask a question.
Sure.
Because, what you pointed to there seemed to me to be, mm-hmm, the central bank governor kind of falling asleep on the job, maybe deliberately or otherwise. Are there any implications, repercussions for a central bank governor, any central bank governor, doing something like that, or being around and responsible when something like that happens?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if there's any right,
mm-hmm,
to prosecute a person like that or to sue them, or whether there's a court case you can bring. I really don't. Richard may have a better idea. I honestly don't know the answer to the question.
Mm-hmm.
It's an area of high national importance,
mm-hmm,
because the people in the country, those people listening to this program and so on, good morning listeners, the people who are saving their money in the little credit unions and the banks, and they have their mortgages and they have their credit cards and their overdrafts and so on, the small businessmen and so, they are not financial experts, and they rely on a qualified and a well-ordered and a rigorous regulator to stop bad things from happening and to remove bad players from the game. So that, in fact, the unhealthy is like a doctor cutting out some part of a body that's unhealthy. So the unhealthy things are reduced, and the healthy influences can prosper and spread. So it's an important responsibility. I don't know whether there's I really honestly don't know the answer, Rhoda.
Okay,
whether
fair
anybody
enough
could be prosecuted or imprisoned, I don't know what.
You're telling me about some of the other things
so
that are meant to come out.
So the governor, the central bank's role is very important in, mm-hmm, all this. There are more things I could say about that beyond Ewart Williams' formal statement on the day of the bailout. There's also the role of the auditors.
Right.
Because we had PricewaterhouseCoopers auditing the CL Financial Group for a substantial number of years. I forget the number of years. It might have been 10 years or something. And I saw the last accounts, and the last accounts didn't disclose anything resembling a crisis. The last accounts that they had before the group collapse was at the end of 2007. Those were published on the 18th of November 2008, nearly 11 months and something later. But they were published. I have them. They're available online. And there's nothing disclosed. Because
so you think Pricewaterhouse was negligent?
I don't know. I'm just saying that there was nothing disclosed in the 2007.
Are you think they were hiding stuff?
Not any idea. The point is, if there was something untoward, like a breach of standards, a breach of accounting rules and so on, and international accounting standards, if those things were in breach, they would be disclosed, and prudential standards and so on, those things would be disclosed in the accountant's letter, the auditor's letter, and that would give rise to what is called a qualified statement. So they would say, listen, we've examined these accounts, However, we want to qualify them because this was not in order. That was not in order. They will identify what was not in order.
But it seems like you're criticizing by the order house in a kind of diplomatic way.
No, I'm actually saying I'm actually anxious to see what Coleman has to say about them. They were represented at the inquiry by Mr. Russell Martino. There was also a Canadian attorney present, and I think they testified as well. But the last accounts they published of CL Financial weren't qualified. And shortly after they were published, I think it was 56 days after they were published, we had the nation in a veritable crisis. So we're being told in a straight face by people with jackets and ties, including one lady in an elegant dress, Karen Nunes de Scherer, that there was a crisis upon us 56 days after the last published accounts gave a picture of apparent.
So 56 days later, Clico hit a crisis.
Yeah, well, not 56 days after the date of the accounts. And the date of the accounts was 31st of December 2007, right. But they were published on the 18th of November.
Right.
2008.
Mm-hmm. So is it
and the crisis took place on the 30th of January, so that is 56 days there.
So mm-hmm. is it possible then that reputable accounting firms can also suffer from the disease of influence in a small island state?
Can you possibly comment, Afra?
It's possible. It's possible. I mean, because what we have happening here is that as I said, we don't know what the findings would be. I've already written stuff in the papers that was critical of the Pricewaterhouse role in the thing, mm-hmm. and some of the happenings of the firm. For what it's worth, I'll declare Pricewaterhouse do my taxes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, not that there's any particularly huge amount of taxes, but Pricewaterhouse do prepare my taxes and they do it well.
And you haven't hit any crises?
Well, not as far as I know.
Okay.
I check every 56 days.
Good,
or so,
good, but, good, 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 good.
But seriously, the point is that influence is a reality. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons that the current standards mm-hmm. relating to the role of auditors in listed companies, every few years you're supposed to change auditors. Because what happens is that relationships develop. So if you have a company that's listed and you're always using me to do your audit, my audit partners become very, very close and very, very chummy with your directors. And because the relationship becomes so close, sometimes they become interlocking, sometimes they become indistinguishable, and sometimes it's possible that people could look the other way when they should be looking straight at what they should be looking at. Yeah. So that's the reason that every few years you change your auditor. So I don't know what actually happened in that situation. Mm-hmm. We'd have to wait for Coleman's report. We won't have to wait long again. And I'm sure it's going to be interesting. Another thing that's going to be interesting as well, so we talked about the governor of the central bank. We uh-huh. talked about the role of the auditors mm-hmm. and so on. The other thing that's going to be interesting is going to be the role of the executive in CL Financial. So we're talking about the executive, people like Mr. Dupree and Mr. Montai. And other people, Ian Garcia and other mm-hmm. people, in the Michael Caballo actually testified. He was mm-hmm. the finance director when the company went down.
A former government minister as well?
Well, yeah, Dr. Tiwari was on the board.
Right.
And you're going to have a situation where, pardon me, I think those people are going to come in for some criticism because some of the investment decisions are what led us to where we are today.
So was it, okay, I have a really curious question. Mm. Well, it's probably not a really curious question. Was the figure, what exactly, you know, what exactly is the bailout? What's the size of this bailout?
Well, I've been trying to
I've been seeing all kinds of weird numbers.
I've been trying to find out.
Is the bailout still going on?
Yeah.
Why are
we still paying money? Or
yes, I'm sure we are.
And why can't we not know what's the size of the bailout? Isn't it public money that we're bailing them out?
It is public money, okay. For sure. I have sued, and I succeeded in my lawsuit on the 22nd of July last year,
mm-hmm.
where I actually got the High Court to make an award in my favor, which was, in fact, to require the government to publish the information I had requested.
Mm-hmm.
And I had requested three classes of information. The first thing I requested was the audited accounts for the company, CL Financial Group. And if the audited accounts were not available, because there's a possibility they could take a look back at you and say there are no audited accounts, in the alternative, whatever figures the Minister of Finance was using, because Ministers of Finance, since this whole thing started, have been quoting figures. Nunes de Scherer quoted figures, Mr. Dukaran quoted figures, Mr. Larry Hawaii quoted figures, and up to the other day, Mr. Imbert was talking with Mr. Dupree, and he was quoting figures.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is either I want the audited accounts or the figures the Minister of Finance quoted. Where did you get those figures from? I want that.
Right.
Second point, I asked for details of a parliamentary briefing. They briefed the parliament, the independent senators in the parliament in the first half of September 2011. And they briefed those independent senators to obtain their support, to obtain their vote in passing two laws relating to the bailout. The first law was a law that would permit the central bank, not the central bank, I'm sorry, the Minister of Finance to borrow an additional $10.7 billion to fund the bailout. And the second law was, in fact, to put an additional layer of protection around the central bank. The central bank is already immune from the Freedom of Information Act by law. This was an additional layer which meant that, in fact, no one would be able to sue the central bank or undertake a judicial review of anything the central bank did or did not do. So this would be looking at a situation of carte blanche. To get those two things passed, they conducted a briefing of the independent senators at the parliament on Ryson Road. The briefing was conducted by Minister of Finance at the time, Mr. Winston Dukoran, and Governor of the Central Bank at the time, Mr. Ewart Williams. And they had a team of people from Ernst & Young and lawyers from the City of London, and they had a big high-power team. And the contents of that briefing have been suppressed. What were they told? Because all of the independent senators voted for it. What
I didn't even know about this.
What were they told? I made an application under the Freedom of Information Act. Dukoran gave a statement in Parliament 16th of September 2011. Promised the Parliament, he started off, "Honorable colleagues, I want to assure you, give you my assurances. I'm preparing a publication of all of the details of this presentation we gave you. It's already 57 pages long. I want to lay it in the public so we can go back and review how this bailout has been conducted." When I made the application under the Freedom of Information, I was told, "You can't get that, it's exempt." So the court awarded me that. And the third thing the court awarded me was the details of who received payments. Correct. So I won the names, I was awarded the names of those who were paid, the dates that they were paid, and that is very important information for us to piece together this puzzle of what has happened to the wealth of our country. Because in my opinion, the wealth of the country, the public wealth, has been diverted by the means of this bailout to assist a very small minority of people.
So wait.
Yes.
So a meeting was held with independent senators.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To make the central bank basically more obscure.
Yes. Absolutely.
To shroud it in secrecy.
To shroud it with even more secrecy.
Yes.
When, to me, the trend should be to more transparency in terms of an institution like that. Because you want the data, you want the figures.
Yes. To be realistic. It's dealing with public money. It's dealing with public money.
In terms
money.
Of where the country is going.
Yeah.
From a data point of view, I just think you need to have the data.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So this meeting was held. You had to take it to court.
Yes.
And the court allowed you, said, "Well, okay, you are entitled to get the information.
Have you gotten it?
No, because the Minister of Finance, who was at the time was Mr. Larry Hawaii, he went and he appealed.
Ah.
So in fact, we are in the appeal court.
Right.
Oh.
And I am in discussions. I mean, so far they've been constructive. The new Minister of Finance is Colm Embert. I hope he's listening. I'm in some constructive discussions with him and hoping that this appeal could be withdrawn and the judgment satisfied. I want to make another point, Richard, that's important about this cloaking the central bank in secrecy. That was called the Central Bank Amendment Act of 2011. It was challenged in court. The actual act itself was challenged in court by the said Mr. Andre Montai. Now, Mr. Montai was one of the kingpins in the whole scenario, the PNM scenario, the CLICO scenario, the country. And he had a block of shares, a controlling block of shares. I think it was 5.7 million shares in Flavorite that had been left inside of CIB, CLICO Investment Bank, which he was the former chairman of. And he was trying to get back his shares, but the central bank said, "No, you can't get it back. These are now our assets." He was saying, "Well, in fact, I've paid back the loan." And in fact, because of that Central Bank Amendment Act, he was unable to conduct a judicial review of the central bank's decision to hold back his shares. And therefore, through the offices of Martin Daly, senior counsel, he brought a lawsuit in the High Court here in Trinidad to actually have the Central Bank Amendment Act declared unconstitutional. It was a really fascinating case. Really, really fascinating. On the one hand, the central bank arguing that they have the right to seek further legal cloaks. Because in a bailout situation, if you leave yourself exposed, you could just run into a battalion of lawsuits and wreck the bailout process. And on the other hand, Daly arguing that his client's rights were being trampled on. And the decision by Justice Ronnie Budu Singh is actually very interesting to read, how he has delved into the argument and made sense of it all and found in favor of Mr. Mondai's company, Stone Street Capital. So in fact, the Central Bank Amendment Act was declared unconstitutional by the High Court in a judgment in October 2013. What is interesting is that, of course, the government immediately went and appealed, because this is like a pattern, mm-hmm. you know, after one time, mm-hmm. another time.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the People's National Movement, which did not vote for either of those two laws in 2011, they didn't support it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, they have not withdrawn that appeal. So it's a similar situation to my own. You see?
Yeah.
So there's a little wrinkle,
yes.
In the tablecloth.
Yes.
In that PNM didn't vote for it. PNM has won the election.
Yeah.
They're now in a position to withdraw the appeal.
And they've not withdrawn it.
The effect of withdrawing the appeal in the Central Bank Amendment Act case would be that the High Court judgment would be unchallenged.
Mm-hmm.
And the act would be effectively extinguished.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because the court had found it to be unconstitutional. But they're not doing that. So...
Why?
Well... It's
is it that it's just not on the priority?
Maybe it's not on the legislative agenda.
Because at this point it's just not on the priority.
But I'm just saying that the whole question of transparency versus obscurity in the bailout is very important. We need to put our efforts into making sure we can find out what happened with our money. I have asked that I want to know all the details of all the payments, because what we are contemplating, I'll share another thought with you colleagues and listeners. What we're contemplating is a figure. Because, Rhoda, you were asking about the total bailout figure.
Yeah.
We're contemplating a figure that was either $24, $25 billion, something like that. That's the kind of figures we've been talking about. Now, I ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
If we started off with 5 back in 2009.
Yeah, because that's the figure I heard in 2009.
And we escalated.
To 20-something.
To 20.
And we're now into 24, 25. We mm-hmm. don't know the exact figure, whatever. How is it that we could have all of these groups still in court wanting to get the money that is owed to them? So for example, last week I had a conversation with Ramesh Lawrence Maraj. Ramesh had taken a case for a particular group to mm-hmm. the Privy Council.
Yes. Yes, he has.
They are owed money.
Yeah.
Another person I had a talk with last week was David Walker. David Walker is the head of a recently formed group called the CLICO Stakeholders Alliance.
Yes.
And they're claiming that they're owed major monies. So how could we have spent $24 billion?
And we've not paid the stakeholders.
And people are still owed major monies. What is really going on here? You see how serious it is?
Yeah.
So we have no idea where that money has gone
to. If it is the $24 billion, we were told at the beginning that the $24 billion was to pay granny's pension.
Yeah.
To pay the policyholders and pensioners and the poor people will suffer and the financial stability, blah, blah, blah. But if what we see now, 7 years later, is that 5 times more money has been spent,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of those people, pensioners and so on,
have not been paid.
Well, I think I need to insist even more firmly, we need to get all the details of all the payments to see what actually really happened here. It's pretty bad. We could be looking at a situation where the conduct of the bailout could also one day, hopefully, be the subject of a commission of inquiry to see what happened. Because the commission of inquiry is only into the collapse. Eh?
Yeah, so it just seems everything is just getting murkier rather than clearing up.
Yeah.
So let's say you get the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you find out where the money was sent to. What happens what happens from there?
Well, I'm going to publish it mm-hmm. to begin with. I mean, it's not going to be anything that I have secretly under my bed or something. I'm going to publish it online.
Okay, so we wouldn't have to bring legislation to get you to reveal it to us.
No, you wouldn't have to. No. I'd publish it for free. But it needs to come out. It's an important repository of information for the development of the civilization. I mean, a couple of people have asked me, including a couple of officials, have asked me, why am I doing this?
Mm-hmm.
What is the purpose? What is driving me? And I've tried to explain to them that what we are doing, all of us, whether we know it or not, wittingly or unwittingly, what we are doing, we're building a civilization.
Mm-hmm.
We're building Caribbean civilization. You don't build a civilization in a vacuum. You build it by efforts, by errors. Sometimes you have successes. But the point about it is, when we think about what we know about ancient Africa or ancient India or something that would have happened in the Roman times in Europe and so on, what we know about those things, we weren't there. We weren't alive. Nobody we know was there. No, uncle and aunt came and told us. We know because along the way, some people did it consciously, some did it unconsciously. Along the way, a record was kept. And we are able to learn from that record. The record sometimes is cultural, so you get it in songs and dances and so. The record is formal, like in a history book. The record could be archaeological. You find bones and things in the ground and so on. But a record was maintained. And those of us who have the consciousness have a responsibility to compile a record of what is taking place here. This is probably one of the most tragic episodes in the history of the Caribbean. Our struggling for selfhood and so on. This is a tragic episode. And it's made quite tragic by the fact that it's an indigenous businessman. It's one of us. It's a man of color. It's a man of African descent. There's a particular note and a glancing consideration of the extent of the tragedy as Caribbean
considering
people,
the repercussions that this has had, I mean, all the way up the sure. region, is there a regional interest for what is going on with the bailout?
Absolutely. It's tremendous interest. I mean, my stuff is taken up regularly in Barbados and Guyana. My writing on it, my writing is at afroraymond.wordpress.com, and it's extensive on this subject. It's taken up in those places. And in fact, there was one column I wrote recently, to give an example of the kind of interest, a column I wrote about 3 weeks ago was called Dupree's Gambit, and I was dealing with the whole question of Lawrence Dupree claiming that he wanted to take back control of the company and so on. This was a big item about 3 weeks ago in the news. And that Dupree's Gambit was published on my blog, which is afroraymond.wordpress.com, with about two or three comments. It was published in the Express. I don't think anybody commented in the Express comment box. And it's published on Barbados Underground. And I think there's over 200 comments on it.
But is that likely?
Is it trying to take back over the company?
Yeah, is that likely? Can that happen?
Well, the way things have been set up, the door has been left open. Because first of all, he wasn't charged any interest. Which means in a proper bailout situation, he would have been charged interest. Let's be really clear on this. One of the biggest issues of negligence and or abandonment of the national interest is that so much money, so much public money has been put into the hands of this man at zero interest. So the wealthiest man in the Caribbean was able to get the largest loan in the history of the Caribbean. And you know what? He got it interest-free. If you try to take a loan from FCB or Rhoda, you were to try to take a loan from Republic Bank, which is also part of the CL Financial Group, you'd sure as hell have to pay interest. Okay? And the fact of the matter is that Mr. Dupree got an interest-free loan, which is the benefit of political access, which is part of today's theme. The other issue, so in fact, had there been interest, that money he was owing would have been multiplying and increasing, and he'd be in no position now to talk about taking back anything. He'd in fact owe the government money far more than the value of the assets. Second point. So in fact, I think the money that is owed to the state, the interest rate, we need to return to that. In the American case, when AIG was being bailed out by the Fed, their interest rate was almost four times above the base rate. Punitive rate of interest was applied. Our wealthiest person in the Caribbean has gotten a zero interest rate. And the second issue is that when those American companies were bailed out within Wall Street, a lot of buffoons here in this country continue to compare what took place here with Wall Street. There's no comparison. There is no comparison. Stop it. There's no comparison. Mr. Dupree, stop it. I hope you're listening. There's no comparison. Those people in Wall Street were made to give up their shares. AIG had to give up 85% of their shares. Okay, Bank of America, 79.9% of the shares. You gave up none of your shares, which is why you are able to present us with these absurd proposals. You want back the company, and you want this, and you want this before you want that, and a whole lot of things.
But outrageous. I saw the central bank governor having a press conference with regard to that. And he says it was under consideration. Am I right, Ruda?
Yeah.
And he said there were conflicting views on the issue, and he wouldn't really want to indicate what those views are at this point.
Right, I bet.
But it was being deliberated upon.
It was under consideration.
Absolutely, I'll bet there were different views. But I mean, at the end of the day, we have a situation where an unprecedented series of benefits was made available to this individual with political access. The public purse has suffered terribly coming out of this. We don't have a proper accounting. It's done tremendous damage to our already weak governance and accountability systems. And we need to really engage very fully with this issue if we are to bring this back on track.
But it seems to me, we're going for a break now, but it seems to me, Afra, that we don't even know quantitatively what the damage is.
We don't know.
That's what I'm fighting for. Yeah. I want to know how much money was spent. And in fact, if they won't give me the audited accounts, I want the figures the Minister of Finance is using. Because look here, Mr. Imbert was saying on the 22nd of May, that is Friday before last, that his books, our books show $24 billion.
Yes.
Well, why can't you give me a copy of those books?
Yeah.
So this is the kind of discussion he and I are having at the moment. So the discussion about trying to resolve all of this without having to go further to court. We have another court date on the 18th of July. And we'll see what happens on that occasion.
Afra, I'm hoping when the Coleman report comes in that you'll be able to come back and discuss that with us.
Yes.
We really look forward to that. And I enjoyed having you here this morning.
Thank you.
So good. Thanks for sharing time with us and the listeners.
No problem. Yes. Thanks very much. Thank you for the help.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Wear some good shirts.
I didn't hear that. Can you say that again?
He said wear some good shirts.
The Pekong. One thing I'm trying to say, Pekong went down, you know.
All right. Thank you, Shawar Jafro. All the best to you.
All
thank you.
All the best. Take care.
All right. Quick break. Come back with the news.
These are the issues.